This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. We're going to do something a little funky to start off this week's episode. I'm going to play you a bit right now of a different show.
Was there ever, like, growing up, was there ever, like, one moment or one interaction where all of a sudden you were like, other people see me differently?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that.
They're probably not disabled people talking to you.
Right, exactly.
Well, that clip there, it's from Pick Last in Gym Class, a podcast and video series that's hosted by the U.S. Paralympian Lacey Henderson. And it debuted this past June.
Because, you know, like, I'm trying to bring the people up, trying to bring my people up.
Lacey Henderson didn't always see people with disabilities as her people. In fact, for a large portion of her life, she didn't even consider herself disabled. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Lacey Henderson was always an active kid. So when she told her parents about a pain in her right leg, they weren't too concerned.
They were like, listen, it's probably nothing. You're probably sore from soccer. It's probably growing pains.
Lacey was 9 years old. She had just started at a new school.
So I was the only new kid. Brutal. And now I was this new kid with this weird limp. And I'm like, no worries. It's just growing pains, guys.
But the pain got worse. Bad enough that Lacey, always one of the top athletes her age, started sitting out gym class.
I couldn't straighten out my knee after a while. So I was just walking on my toes. And I got to a point where my school's calling my parents and they're like, what is wrong with Lacey's leg? Like, what is actually going on?
Lacey's parents took her to get an x-ray. Nothing seemed unusual.
We got a prescription for an MRI, and that was where there was a tumor about the size of a light bulb shown inside of my kneecap.
Lacey went in for a biopsy.
We talked about cancer. I didn't know anything about it. As a 9-year-old, I was like, I've heard the word cancer. I see bald people, so probably not me because I have all my hair. Like, it just didn't, like, things didn't make sense. But I wake up from the biopsy. I remember just being groggy and, like, the recovery room nurse is checking my vitals and my bags or whatever. And I was like, do I have cancer? And she was just so nonchalant. She's like, yeah, honey, you do.
Lacey had a rare form of cancer called synovial sarcoma.
And I remember I laid back down, I put my face in the pillow, I started crying. And I just knew, like, at that moment, even though she seemed kind of cool with it, like, I was like, I just know that this is something big and I'm not going to be the same. And I'm scared. It was really scary.
She says doctors wanted to amputate her leg immediately, but she and her family wanted to try chemotherapy first. Lacey was supposed to do 6 full treatments. She only got through 3 because the chemo caused Lacey's organs to fail.
There was, like, points when I was in the hospital where I was getting my vitals checked every 15 minutes. And I'll never forget May 17th, 1999, we had a meeting, and it was just like one of these conference rooms with 4 or 5 doctors and my family, and we, you know, we were discussing our options, and there were not many options at this point. So our doctor, he spoke with other surgeons across the country, and he's like, listen, we could try to peel this thing off like a potato. He's like, I can't promise I'm going to get all your cancer cells. If we don't, we'll have to amputate really high. It's still a lot more chemo. It's a lot more radiation. It's a lot more treatment. Or we amputate if you want to survive.
2 days later, doctors amputated Lacey's right leg above her knee. After that surgery and one final round of chemo that ended on her 10th birthday, Lacey got ready to go back to school, now wearing a pediatric prosthetic leg.
I didn't know anything about the world of disability. I'd never been around people with disabilities. I always, like, equated physical disability with developmental disabilities. And so when I joined the physically disabled world, I was like, oh, I'm still the same. I just got one leg. Like, no problem. So I go back to school. I'm back with my same classmates, and we got really into playing basketball during recess. And, you know, usually I'm like a top 3 pick. like without question, never had to question it. And kids' names are getting called, and I'm like, all right, okay, I'll be realistic. Like, my hair is growing back. I still definitely look like I'm recovering from cancer. I have this pediatric prosthetic leg, which is like rainbow. It's like a glorified door hinge. And I'm like, all right, okay, maybe I'll be middle of the pack. Let's be realistic. So kids' names keep getting called, and we're down to like the last 3 or 4 kids. I'm starting to get a little nervous. And I wasn't even picked at all. I wasn't picked last. They just started playing without me. And it dawned on me in that moment that even though I knew I was the same person, people saw me as different.
The thing was, Lacey Henderson understood her classmates' reaction.
Because I saw people with disabilities as being different than who I was. And I honestly, I felt that way. I was like, you know, I have an amputation, but I'm not disabled. You know, I just my leg comes off. And I call that disability denial. And I just knew, I was like, I need to be able to prove to people that I can do whatever it is that I want to do.
I'm sexy, I'm cute, I'm popular to boot.
And then a few years later, a huge moment in my life happened. It was the movie Bring It On came out. I don't know if that was as life-changing for other people, but for me, that was an ultimate. That was it. Those girls were so cool. They could do flips. They were sassy. They, like, you know, they had cute uniforms. And I told my mom, I'm like, I want to be a cheerleader. And she's like, oh, God, okay. Just like, how are we going to do this? And they signed me up for gymnastics classes, and I had amazing coaches that never put limits on me. They're like, you know, we'll just figure it out.
Lacey became an all-state high school cheerleader. And then in 2007, she enrolled at the Division I University of Denver, where she got an athletic scholarship to be on the school's cheerleading team. Lacey cheered all 4 years at the University of Denver.
And one fateful day, my dad and I... Okay, I'll tell you the real story. Okay, so I'm a senior in college. Yeah, I'm a senior in college. My dad is an older gentleman. I taught him how to play beer pong. And, you know, I was of age at this point, you know, just of age, but
for
I was of
record.
Age. And let me tell you, he destroyed me. So the only way that I could really stand up for myself, I think, was to start talking mad trash to my dad. And somehow the conversation turned into who's a better athlete. And he went to Olympic trials for pole vault. Somehow he was like, listen, Lace, he's like, you couldn't learn to pole vault 2 feet. And that was really all I needed. I feel like I spent my whole life just constantly trying to tell people they couldn't put limits on me. They couldn't tell me what I could or couldn't do. So the next day, I didn't know anything about running prosthetics. I just showed up on one of my old beater legs, one of my old legs that I didn't wear anymore. And I jumped 6 feet.
Lacey proved her dad wrong. And something else happened, too. See, Lacey's time as a cheerleader at the University of Denver was coming to an end. But she realized she wanted to keep her athletic career going. And that's when she learned about the Paralympics.
My dad and my mom, they come from an older generation, so even raising me, they're like, no special stuff. No specials. We're not going to put you in any special programs. You're the same. You know, we were all kind of in this denial of my disability.
Through one of her dad's friends, Lacey was invited to a race for para-athletes.
I go to this race, and I'm just like, you know, 21 years old, 22 years old, just like way overconfident in everything. And I'm like, I'm a Division I athlete. I'm going to race against these people with disabilities. I'm about to blow them out the water. So we line up, and I get a good start, and, you know, we start racing. All of a sudden, I just hear like pounding behind me, and it's just people's blades just hitting the ground hard, and I get swallowed up in this race. And I'm like, Dad, I got beat really bad by a girl with no legs. And I was like, oh my God, these are some fast girls. My ego, my pride was real bruised. And I'm like, I realized, first of all, disabled sport is not any special, you know, like participation trophy type sport. And two, I was not going to be the person that lost. Like, no way.
Around that same time, Lacey had volunteered at what she calls AMP Camp.
It's a youth camp for kids with limb loss and limb deficiencies. And I learned so much more about myself. I feel like I got so much more out of camp than I gave to these kids, which, sorry guys, if I robbed you guys. But I think I'd never really allowed myself, I think, to grieve the loss of a leg. And I think when I realized that I wasn't as fast or as strong as these people who had accepted that about themselves, I'm like, okay, maybe you guys are onto something.
Lacey trained at track, and she says she developed into a pretty decent racer. But in 2013, she started long jumping, And she was even better at that.
Within my first three competitions, I broke a 17-year-long American record.
And as Lacey rose in the world of para-athletics, she found her place in a global community of para-athletes. And at the 2016 Paralympics in Rio, Lacey represented the U.S. in two events, the 100-meter dash,
Henderson from the USA in seven, fifth in the 100,
and the long jump. Lacey finished eighth. That led Lacey Henderson to an opportunity with a production company to host her own podcast and video series. Lacey Henderson had spent the first part of her life trying to maintain a barrier between herself and the disabled community. She'd finally come to accept her place on the other side of that barrier. And now she had a new goal. She was going to help tear that barrier down. So for her new show, Lacey would feature guests with disabilities, but not only guests with disabilities.
It was like, well, let's just get everybody. We're like, let's get everybody and let's just have fun conversations about struggles before success and just find the parallels of disability with everything else.
There's a conversation with an able-bodied Radio Disney host about bullying and a conversation with an able-bodied comedian about staying motivated when success doesn't come right away. And when it comes to talking about disability, there are a lot of laughs.
Were you born visually impaired?
I was. For a long time, I told people that my disease was congenial.
Congenial.
Turns out it's congenital.
It's friendly, but it also has...
Yeah, exactly. And it's so funny.
Well, for sure, there's a lot of self-deprecating humor. it's terrible, but disability is hilarious. And when you enter the world of disability, you have to laugh at yourself. Otherwise, it would be soul-crushing.
So I remember waiting in line at McDonald's at the Games, and there was this athlete actually from Egypt. And I remember she was in a chair, and she kept trying to cut us. And we were like, no. And she, we finally were like, no, you can't cut us. She's like, no, I'm disabled. At the Paralympics, and finally we were like,
what?
Listen, we're all disabled.
Lacey Henderson hopes her show can offer community for those with disabilities who might feel isolated. And she thinks Picked Last in Gym Class can give listeners, whether they're disabled or not, a deeper and more honest understanding of people with disabilities.
You get a sense of people and their personality, and it's almost kind of exciting sometimes when you can't see somebody, because maybe if you would see somebody who's a full quad in a power chair, your assumption about their capabilities or intellectual capabilities would be different than you just hear them speaking. So it's cool.
Well, that's something really cool, I think, that you've done, because your character on Breaking Bad, it had depth. It wasn't just this person that swings by and just has a disability, and their whole story is their disability, and that's it. And I feel like right now
that story is from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Lacey Henderson, she's the host of Pick Last in Gym Class, which is my favorite title for a podcast now. She's slated to compete at the 2019 World Para Athletic Championships starting this week in Dubai. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Happy Halloween, nerds. This week, don't miss a special, spooky batch of episodes from NPR's new daily science podcast, Shortwave.
We're going to talk about parasites that take over and control the brains of their hosts.
Yes.
Much like a podcaster does to their audience.
Listen and subscribe to Shortwave from NPR.
I'm Jason Gay, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Here they are, one strike away, one out away. 3-2. Here it is! The Washington Nationals are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
Let's be honest. I fell asleep on the couch. But while I was sleeping on Wednesday night, Washington, D.C. got itself another championship, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Welcome back, Amira Rose.
Hey, how are you?
And by the Washington Post, Jerry Brewer. Welcome back, Jerry, and please lead us off here.
Jason and Amira Rose, when you refer to the nation's capital, please use District of Champions. After a 26-year drought, the Washington Capitals broke through in 2018 and won the Stanley Cup. We now have two championships in 2019, the WNBA Mystics and the Washington Nationals. And if you really want to stretch the region, you can go all the way to Virginia, and we'll take that one too. The Virginia Cavaliers winning the NCAA men's basketball.
Look at
so
that.
We are talking about four championships in less than 2 years. But I do think that it's a bit ridiculous and kind of aimed at irritating, riling up fans when we try to force our superiority on others and try to force inferiority on others. However, I will say this, guys. It feels good to be the District of Champions.
All right, Amira Rose, what do you think? Should we take any civic satisfaction in collecting championships like DC's been doing?
Well, I mean, are they collecting championships? It's cute, okay? It's cute. As somebody who's from Massachusetts, you know, I'm very familiar with what it feels like to actually be like a title town. In the period of time when the Red Sox were winning and then the Patriots were winning, especially in the 2000s, early 2000s, there was something different in the air. I think people are happier.
I want to note that Amira said when the Red Sox were winning. They won the title in 2018.
I know.
Talk
I
about
know.
Being spoiled in Massachusetts.
Jerry, I can't help but detect a conspiracy here, though, because I think as long as the district talks about the Caps, the Nats, the Mystics, and even those Cavaliers down there in Charlottesville, it's a way to not talk about the Wizards and that Landover-based football team I call Dan Snyder's Washington Sadness Machine. Mm-hmm. There is a not terribly successful corner of this town's sports legacy right now. Is that fair to say?
That is absolutely fair to say. And yes, we are trying to cover up some of the stench.
Well, it's nice to see that people are finally celebrating the Mystics because it feels like now it's very convenient to acknowledge their championship.
They shouldn't get hidden in all this.
No, that's for sure.
Elena Delladone is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Amira Rose, what's on your mind this week?
Yeah, so in mid-October, Bulgaria was playing a match, a football match, soccer, with England. And you saw a number of Nazi salutes, racist chanting directed towards the black soccer players on the English team. This is the third time in 6 months that Bulgaria has had an issue with racial abuse in their stands from their fans. So this week, UEFA doled out the punishment. So they had the option of suspending Bulgaria from the European Championships all together in the spring, and they stopped just short of doing that. Instead, they mandated that the next game they play has to be behind closed doors. That will cost them close to 100,000 euros. They also were levied a fine of 85,000 euros. This ruling was blasted by FAIR, by Kick It Out, by other agencies on the ground who are monitoring this and are putting in these protocols, saying this is not enough. And so it seems to me like this protocol and these punishments are only going to be effective if they actually are sent down.
In this case, I think that you just have to punish everyone. It's unfortunate that the athletes would be subject to this, but I would scorch the earth. Yeah. I would make them ineligible. I mean, we're talking about three instances in 6 months. And we're talking about an issue, you know, if you want to expand it, you know, around the globe, there are a lot of issues worldwide with soccer fans. And I think sometimes you have to make a statement, you know, do you want this as a part of the game or do you want to eradicate it? And in order to eradicate it, I think this is a case in which you should scorch the earth. Number one, it's the right thing to do. Number two, Bulgaria is pretty terrible at soccer.
So bad.
I mean, it's not like you're punishing Argentina or Brazil or someone. And in this instance, the displays and just the amount of racism is so heavy that you don't want to come across as too lenient or soft.
I mean, I think it's an absolute disgrace, obviously, and I'm on board with the scorched earth approach. I do think a ban, a total ban with the possibility to be reconsidered after a year or two would be the proper approach here. These kinds of things where you are doing these sort of minimal approaches have not worked. Awareness doesn't seem to work. There have been all kinds of public service campaigns and enlisting athletes to contribute here. I'm with Jerry here.
Yeah, I completely agree with you guys. And I think one interesting part of this to watch is that the folks from Fair and Kick It Out, who are doing such an amazing job, they're calling attention to the fact that the governing body that gives out the disciplinary actions is 10 men and has no ethnic or racial diversity on this committee at all.
So to borrow the title of your podcast, Amira Rose, it's time to burn it all down.
Yes.
All right. Let's move over to the illustrious world of, and the glamorous world, really, of sports media and talk about Deadspin. This is a beloved, irreverent, sometimes crude and roguish website that lost most of its staff this week in a dispute with its new bosses who wanted this website to stick to, predictable drum roll, please, to stick to sports. Deadspin's writers and editors didn't want to do that because they've never really done that. That's not really what that website has been about. I think this is a shame. I fear that this is the way that a lot of this stuff is heading. What's your take, Amira Rose?
It's really such a shame. Deadspin was a site that evolved, that had amazing content, that had talented editors and writers, that wasn't afraid to just be very blunt and understood that sports were inherently political, and was able to walk and chew gum at the same time and cover a lot of things. And they were hilarious.
I mean, Jerry, you probably get some of the same emails I get every once in a while. Whenever anything verges into politics, they'll say, stick to sports, Jerry. And I just feel like, you know, that kind of declaration is ridiculous. But what's your thought on it?
It is ridiculous. I mean, everything in the world is connected, and we can't celebrate some of the things that the sports world has done to further society and then say, when it's something that you disagree with, oh, no, just stick to sports. I mean, it's never been just about sports.
The opinion that you hear every now and again is from folks like, I just want sports to be a refuge, Amira Rose. I want to just make me happy. Like, I don't want to find out about what's going on in Washington. And I don't know if that's possible. What do you think?
I don't think it's possible. I think you're putting your head in the sand. You know what? If you need an escape, okay, go play Candyland. I don't know what to tell you. Like, sports are always and have always been and will always be political. And I also don't like this thing where we pretend like there's not a million and one places to just get sports content.
Yeah,
like, go
true.
Over to ESPN. Like, you still can get that.
Amira Rose, I don't know how you play Candyland, but when I do, it's intensely political. I'm just telling you right now. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and also reporting live from the District of Champions, the Washington Post, Jerry Brewer. My thanks, and enjoy those parades, DC fans.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
ESPN, you know, big behemoth ESPN, it debuted 40 years ago this September. And if you had tuned in on that first day, you would have been greeted by this.
Beyond that blue horizon is a limitless world of sports. And right now, you're standing on the edge of tomorrow. Sports, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. With ESPN, the
but,
total sports.
You know, not every sports fan got to experience this limitless world of sports right away. Some people had to wait for cable to be installed in their neighborhoods. Cable! Can you imagine it, kids, with your Bluetooth and your headsets and your iPads? Boston sports writer Lee Montville, a true legend, he had to wait more than a year and a half to get his first taste of ESPN. And when he did, he turned the experience into a column for the Boston Globe. In honor of ESPN's 40th anniversary, we decided to give Lee's column a double play. That's what we call it when we turn a great piece of writing into a radio drama.
Leroy Witherspoon now.
A guy named Leroy Witherspoon came dribbling across my eyes at 3 in the afternoon. The clock was ticking down. The crowd was going wild. I was going wild.
5 seconds.
5, 4, 3. Leroy let it go.
Witherspoon with 3 seconds left.
2, 1. The ball went through the hoop. A definite swish. A 30-footer. Did you see that? I asked. Silence. Did you see it? I demanded. I was alone. I was sick. I was screaming about something that had happened almost 2 days earlier. I was screaming about the fact that Potsdam State had tied Augustana College to send the Division III NCAA basketball final into overtime. I don't know where Augustana is located. I'm a little hazy about Potsdam. I knew none of the players involved. I did know that Potsdam won in overtime. I knew that tape-delayed fact already, having read it 2 days earlier on the scores pages of a newspaper. I still was screaming. Never in my worst sports junkie moments, not even on a spectacular fall afternoon, the family out in the leaves, me in the living room with a football game involving the nondescript Kansas City Chiefs or the St. Louis Cardinals or the Detroit Lions, had I felt this bad. This was Florida. People in Boston would kill to be 20 feet outside my motel room door, sitting at the pool on a workday Wednesday afternoon with a pina colada and a smile in the 80-degree sunshine. I was watching Leroy and Potsdam on my glow-in-the-dark little television, located 2 feet from the fly swatter in the Gideon Bible. Help me, Father, for I have sinned. I was hooked on ESPN. I had never seen it before, you know? I had heard rumors.
They have it in Malden.
My brother has it in Springfield.
24 hours of televised sports every day of the week.
I always had said I'd wanted it. I demanded it. Bring me the cable. Bring it and bring it now. I was outraged that my area of the United States was so tardy in receiving this greatest technological breakthrough in the history of mankind. I found now that I couldn't stand it. Or worse yet, that I couldn't handle it. ESPN, which went on the air in September of 1979, just pumps those sports at you. Sports you never knew existed. Sports you never cared existed. Ask me if I would walk across the street to watch Potsdam play Augustana, and I would laugh. Ask me if I didn't have to walk anywhere, just turn the knob. I watched track from New Zealand. Auto racing from Bristol, Tennessee, Division II, or was it Division III, swim championships from some steamy pool, a taped tennis match from Rotterdam that I saw three separate times, Jimmy Connors against Sandy Mayer. It was just so easy. Get up in the morning and turn on the set. A fight is on. Freddie Roach of Dedham, no less. Sit and watch. Go somewhere, do something. Return to the room to shave. Turn on the set again. Gymnastics. Prepare to go to bed. No, turn on the set. Just to check. Sports Center. Every score of every game ever played. Followed by soccer from England. Yes! Crystal Palace against Tottenham Hotspurs. By God, that's old Mike Flanagan of the T-Men out there. Fall asleep as the action fades to more New Zealand track.
From a very fine run by this artist.
I began to feel as if I were on a diet of honey-dipped glazed donuts. Excuse me. I began to feel physically ill. If too much is not good for you, as Mother always said, this definitely was too much. The set controls you. There is no time nor inclination to watch the rest of television anymore. Not even the news. There is no inclination to read books, newspapers, anything. Turn the knob, watch the games. No need to talk. I called ESPN yesterday to see what I would be missing today, because my week in that motel room has ended. I will be missing midnight, Martin Luther King games, decathlon 1, 1 a.m., auto racing 1980, a look back, a look ahead, 2:30 a.m., SportsCenter, 3 a.m., top-ranked boxing from Philadelphia, 5:30 a.m., NCAA volleyball Golden Dome Classic semifinal, 7 a.m., SportsCenter, 8 a.m., professional rodeo from Mesquite, Texas. 10 a.m., SportsCenter. 11 a.m., NCAA Gymnastics Division II. That's just half the day, with shows like Arizona State Baseball and Superstar Volleyball Cup and the Virginia 500 to follow in the afternoon and night. How many homes are you in now? I asked the ESPN man.
8.9 million,
he replied.
We project we'll be in 30 to 35 million by the middle of the 80s.
In the long-distance future, do you expect you'll be in every home before 1990 as cable moves down every street in America?
We would think so.
My palms sweat at the thought. I have seen the future, and it is Leroy Witherspoon on a sunny Wednesday afternoon.
That's our double play of The Tube That Won't Let You Up by Lee Montville. The column was first published in the Boston Globe in April of 1981, and we rediscovered it recently in John Shulian's new anthology of classic sports columns called The Great American Sports Page. Thanks to our actors, Gordon Ellis, Kelvin Brooks, Sarah Rose Brenner, Matt Lissette, and the inimitable Dave Faniff. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce, and don't forget to follow us on the Facebook and the Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
People are obsessed with zombies, whether it's watching them be hacked away on TV or planning for the apocalypse.
So this week on Throughline, we're exploring the origins of the zombie. And just like the movies, it's a dark one.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
Zombies don't laugh like that, though.
No, that's true.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, Taco Fall. You love him. He's 7 feet. He's 5 inches. How he's trying to make a mark in the NBA while also trying to establish his dominance in another game, Marco Polo. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
Charlie, this week, the NCAA, your favorite organization, it signaled, because it really didn't give a blueprint or a deadline, its willingness to finally allow college athletes to financially capitalize on name, image, and likeness. Now, this follows the whole state of California thing where they passed a bill sanctioning the same thing. Charlie, is this a case of the NCAA finally starting to get it when it comes to big-time college sports?
Well, listen, after watching the NCAA operate for nearly 40 years, they finally learned how to embrace the inevitable. That's a big step for them. That's a really big step for them. And I know there are a lot of people who have been beating their heads against the same wall I have for the last 40 years who are saying that this is smoke and mirrors and isn't really what it seems to be. First of all, every state in the union was going to pass one of these laws. Florida was already on deck. And, you know, certainly Pennsylvania would be there because God knows the people in Pennsylvania have no love for the NCAA. So the NCAA, you know, they decided to bow to the inevitable. And anybody who thinks this is just, you know, a smoke and mirrors illusion, wait a couple of years because now the dam's broken. Now the entire principle of amateurism is gone.
This has, like, really broad bipartisan support. You have Democratic, Republican lawmakers all putting these bills forward. Is this just a case of the money getting so big that you just couldn't put your head in the sand anymore?
Well, I think that's part of it, and I certainly sat in on the O'Bannon trial in Oakland for a few days and saw how the normal judicial system reacted to NCAA regulations, and it was not good, let me tell you. But I think if you're basically an American and somebody says to you, this kid has been offered $7,000 to let the local car dealership use his face because he's the biggest star in Starkville, Mississippi, 99.99% of Americans, given that set of facts, would say, of course he should.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't cling to illogic that long.
And to underline here, we are not talking about universities paying student athletes.
Oh, but we'll
play.
Get to
We're
that.
Talking about
we'll get around.
We
to
will
that.
Get to that. So you think this is a stepping stone to eventually get there?
Oh, I don't know that it's a stepping stone. It's the giant crack in the dam. There's no stopping the remuneration of elite college athletes now. You cannot, you know, draw a line now and say you will go this far and no further. This is the beginning of the end of the old order.
Meanwhile, Charlie, the Golden State Warriors, people expected them to have a rough season, but it's just gotten much rougher this week because Steph Curry is now out with a broken hand. You got Kevin Durant is no longer with the team. Klay Thompson's out probably for the entire season. Now Curry, Charlie, is it time for the Warriors to think about tanking?
Well, they say no. And I think October or the beginning of November, it's not the time to start tanking. It's time to start thinking about tanking, maybe. But it's not time to start committing consumer fraud all over the country for the next 7 months. It is kind of tough, though, and boy, the air has gone out of this dynasty in a hurry.
Yeah. In another bit of NBA news, there was a rock'em sock'em old classic between big men Joel Embiid and Karl-Anthony Towns. You know, considering how cozy NBA stars are today, Charlie, did you like some of this throwback fighting happening on an NBA court?
I don't like fighting. I don't like basketball fights in particular because I'm old enough to remember Kermit Washington.
Oh,
and I'm old enough to remember Daryl Dawkins and my former college next door neighbor, Maurice Lucas, squaring off in a face-off that luckily nobody threw a punch. But you're talking about very big guys with rubber-soled shoes on wooden floors. I mean, it's not like hockey where, you know, you struggle to get purchase with your feet. And it's not like baseball where nobody's really serious about it. And it's not like football where everybody's wearing body armor. This is someplace you can do some, as we know, you can do real damage. So I am not a big fan of, you know, flashback NBA as far as that's concerned.
And finally, Charlie, it's good to be the NHL Stanley Cup champions, but it's even better when Halloween rolls around. I'll let you take it from here.
Ryan O'Reilly, which, by the way, is a tremendous name, and David Perrin showed up at the St. Louis Blues Halloween thing that they do for charity, dressed as each other. And people say that you can't tell one hockey player from another.
Halloween, it's become this thing in the NHL and other leagues lately. There were a ton of other good ones, right?
Connor McDavid was a Grinch, and a very impressive-looking one, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
The Bruins all dressed up like toys.
Okay.
Jordan Eberle dressed up as the Tooth Fairy, and boy, is he going to hear about that for the rest of the year. And, of course, there's always the wonderful Gritty in Philadelphia, for whom every day is Halloween.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
So Japan has just gone rugby mad as the country hosts the 2019 Rugby World Cup.
The Rugby World Cup has come to Asia for the very first time, breaking new ground.
The opening ceremonies, they featured kabuki dancers and a children's choir surrounding a huge model of Mount Fuji.
This next section addresses the history of rugby in Japan.
Dates, images, they were projected onto the sides of Mount Fuji starting with 1823, when a British student named William Webb Ellis, playing the game we would call soccer, picked up the ball and ran with it, quote-unquote, inventing the sport of rugby.
Essentially a rugby ball from William Webb Ellis himself becomes a seed of light.
The images fast-forwarded to 1899, when a school teacher at Keio University was credited with first introducing the sport in Japan. But you know what? That's not how it actually happened. And the real story, it involves samurai, British warships, and an armed cricket match. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Mike Galbraith is a rugby historian who lives in the town of Rugby. Really, it's an actual town in England, home of the rugby school, where the sport was first invented sometime in the 1820s.
That part is not in dispute, but whether William Webb Ellis, the World Cup is named after William Webb Ellis, whether he actually invented rugby is disputed, heavily disputed.
Galbraith grew up in England, but he's spent much of his life in Japan. That's where he is right now, for the World Cup. Galbraith first arrived in Japan in 1973, when he was on what he calls a world tour, and he stayed, in large part, because of rugby.
Well, when I first came to Japan, I wasn't aware that people played rugby. But I shared an apartment with an American guy. He was working as a movie extra.
Galbraith says the movie's title, translated into English, was Japan Sinks or something like that. Days on set were long, so Galbraith's housemate started talking to the actor sitting next to him, a rugby player from Australia.
He said, oh, my friend, he likes rugby. As a result of this, I went down to the Yokohama Country and Athletic Club. I said, I'd like to try out. And they said, okay, play in our second team. And then they said, that's good. Next week, you're in the first team. That's how I started.
14 years later, Galbraith was still in Japan, still playing rugby.
1987, I was the captain of the Yokohama team.
The Yokohama team wanted to attend the first Rugby World Cup, being held that year in Australia and New Zealand. To raise money, they sold advertising in a tour program. And to fill some space, Galbraith set out to write a history of rugby in Japan. The story that everyone believed was, by that point, well established.
In Japan, there seems to be a desire to have a nice, happy story where the Western sport is introduced by a single Westerner and the Japanese take it up and become good at it. So in the case of rugby, his name was Edward Bramwell Clark.
Edward Bramwell Clark was born in Japan, but he was educated at Cambridge. As the story goes, when Clark returned to Japan and began teaching English at Keio University in Tokyo, he wanted to give his students a more constructive way to spend their free time. So he taught him the game of rugby. The year was 1899.
That's the official story from the Japan Rugby Union.
But when Galbraith started looking through the archives at the Yokohama Country and Athletic Club, he didn't have to search very hard to find an account that seemed in conflict with that official story.
It started with, it was said that British Tommies played the sport in the 1860s.
This account of British soldiers playing the sport in the 1860s, it hadn't been lost exactly, but historians had always treated it as a one-off, something that didn't connect to the story of how the game caught on in Japan. Galbraith wrote up what he'd found for that tour program, and that was it until 2009. This time, Galbraith was arranging a tour of Japan for a British rugby team called Oxbridge. Again, he needed to raise money, so again, he decided to make a program and include a history of rugby in Japan.
Oxbridge is quite prestigious, so I decided to make more effort this time.
Galbraith went back to the archives, and this time he found definitive proof that rugby had a foothold in Japan more than three decades before Edward Bramwell Clark taught the game to his students at Keio University.
People might think that I looked through millions of pages of newspapers and I came across this article. That's not really true.
In fact, almost right away, Galbraith found a book that pointed him to an article that documented the creation of the Yokohama Football Club in 1866.
When I read it, I thought, wow, this is amazing. I thought, this is very, very early.
1866, that's older than any other rugby team in all of Asia.
But then when I took the information to the Japan Rugby Union, they said, thank you very much, but they would never recognize it.
No matter. Galbraith kept searching, and that search brought him to the year 1859.
Until 1859, foreigners were not allowed to come into Japan or reside in Japan at all. Commodore Perry came with his what's called the black ships, steamships with powerful guns. So the Japanese were forced to open up.
3 years later, in 1862, an English merchant named Charles Lennox Richardson decided to spend some time in Yokohama on his way home from Shanghai.
One day he went riding with some of his friends in Yokohama. Unfortunately for him, a few hours earlier, a daimyo, which is the kind of lord, and his retinue had set off from Tokyo to go to Kyoto. And they came into contact. They collided maybe 3 or 4 miles from Yokohama.
Nobody's exactly sure what happened next. Some accounts say Richardson didn't show the proper respect to the daimyo. Others suggest Richardson's horse spooked. But what we do know is that Richardson was killed by the daimyo's samurai. Tensions escalated. The Japanese emperor issued an edict requiring all foreigners to leave the country by May 11, 1863. But the merchants refused to go. British warships came into the harbor to protect them.
There were marines on the warships, but, you know, it would take quite a while for them to get ashore and protect you if there was an attack, you see.
So the day after the deadline was set to expire, the merchants invited the Navy ashore for a cricket match.
And so one team is called the shore team. So that was the merchants. And then one was called the Navy. The ground they played on was ringed by Marines. But there is an account that says the wicketkeeper was carrying a pistol, and he would put the pistol behind the stumps and take six balls and over, and then he'd pick up the pistol, walk to the other end, put it down behind there.
And this is where we get back to rugby, because in the accounts of that armed cricket match, Galbraith found one description that said,
half the players were playing football.
And of course, in this case, football means rugby, right?
Not really. I think it was an early form of rugby rules football.
Keep in mind, this was 1863. Rugby wouldn't officially become a sport until 8 years later in 1871. But Galbraith has done his research, and he's confident that the style of football played on that day would have been the style played at the rugby school. Galbraith eventually linked the Yokohama Football Club, founded in 1866, to the Yokohama Country and Athletic Club that he joined in 1973, meaning that those early games played by British Tommies weren't one-offs. They were part of a continuous tradition of the sport in Japan. In 2015, with all of his new evidence in hand, Galbraith again approached the Japan Rugby Union to try to persuade them to change their official history.
And I sent my evidence, copies of the key articles that I found, and I sent it to them. And I didn't get any response.
With help from a friend, Galbraith was finally able to get a response, though it wasn't the one he was hoping for.
He called them up, and they told him, we are not interested in rebutting your evidence, and we're not interested in accepting your evidence. We're just not interested in what you've given us.
But as the 2019 World Cup was approaching, officials in Yokohama decided to embrace their connection to rugby's early history. That's why, late last month, the head of Japan's rugby union unveiled a commemorative plaque in a public park near the site where the Yokohama Football Club was first established in 1866. Mike Galbraith was there.
I'd actually just flown from London, so I wasn't there for the plaque unveiling, but I arrived half an hour later. And at the press conference, I was asked what my thoughts were. I said to them, there is a saying in Japanese, which translated into English means, sit on a rock for 3 years. Be patient. So I said to them, I'm very happy to be able to get off this rock after 10 years. And they all laughed.
That story came to us from Only a Game's Karen Gibbon. The Rugby World Cup, it wrapped this weekend with the final match at Yokohama Stadium. Only a Game, it's produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director, Marquise Neal. Our executive producer, Karen Gibbon. Me, I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thank you for listening. And hi, Mom.